Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC, our podcast featuring conversations with experts on death penalty issues. I'm Robert Dunham, DPIC's Executive Director, and today we're joined by University of Baltimore law professor John Bessler, the author of five books and a number of book chapters about the death penalty. Today we'll be speaking with Professor Bessler about his most recent project, Against the Death Penalty, which is a book version of Justice Stephen Breyer's landmark dissenting opinion in the 2015 Supreme Court case Glossop versus Gross. John, welcome back to DPIC's podcasts, and thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me start with a couple of very basic questions about your new book. Justice Breyer is listed as the author. You're listed as the editor. Would you tell our listeners a bit about the format of the book, how you got the idea to do it, and how you persuaded Justice Breyer to go along with it?
Well, actually, I got a phone call from Strobe Talbot, the head of the Brookings Institution, and he asked me to do this book. And I know Justice Breyer has worked previously with the Brookings Institution Press. Justice Breyer gets no remuneration from this book. But at the center of the book lies Justice Breyer's dissent in the Glossop versus Gross case. And that's the case in which both he and Justice Ginsburg announced for the first time in a judicial opinion that it's likely that the death penalty is unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment's Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. And so what I've done with the book to make it more accessible is I've taken the citations in the legal opinion out of the actual text. I put those in endnotes so you can read the opinion directly through. If you want to look at the citations, you can find those. They're just in the endnotes, which are also annotated to add some additional information to the book. And then I've also written a lengthy introduction to the book to contextualize the importance of Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion in Glossop versus Gross.
I want to ask you about that in a second, but one thing that caught my eye is the book is called Against the Death Penalty, and the jacket cover starts by saying, "Does the death penalty violate the Constitution? In Against the Death Penalty, Justice Stephen Breyer argues, yes, it does." And as you just said, in fact, in the book, in the opinion itself, Justice Breyer and Ginsburg don't actually say they believe the death penalty is unconstitutional. They say it's now likely unconstitutional. And then they invite folks in the defense community essentially to file challenges because they think it's time for the court to review it. Given that Justice Breyer gave the go-ahead to the book and it says it's against the death penalty, it's called Against the Death Penalty, the jacket represents that the opinion says he's against the death penalty. Is he actually against the death penalty?
Well, I think it's very unlikely, given the publication of the book, that he's likely to go back and change his mind, given the opinion he wrote. If you go look at the opinion, really what he says is there's three reasons why the death penalty should be considered to be cruel and unusual punishment. The first one is that the convictions are unreliable. There's been a lot of convictions in death penalty cases have been overturned. We've got wrongful convictions. The Death Penalty Information Center actually does a good job of detailing those cases. Secondly, he says the death penalty is arbitrary. He says, you know, look at the counties, essentially, where the death penalty is actually occurring. It's a very small percentage compared to the rest of the country of counties actually producing death sentences. And the third thing he says is that, look at what's called the death row phenomenon. Look at how long people are spending on death row. When Justice Breyer looks at this question, he says it's been over 17 years on average when you have an execution of how long that person's actually spent on death row. And for that reason, he says the death penalty has become unusual. So I think that for those reasons, I mean, he and Justice Ginsburg have asked for a full briefing on the question of the death penalty's constitutionality. But given the way the opinion reads, I think it's highly unlikely that Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg would then turn around and say that, well, you know, the death penalty is fine. I don't think that's going to happen because the factual basis for their opinion, I think, is very solid in terms of laying that out. And so what they're really asking is for a judicial examination of these facts, which they're laying out in the opinion. And remember, the opinion itself and the case itself was not about the constitutionality of the death penalty per se. It was about the use of a particular drug in Oklahoma.
I was going to ask you about that because there are lots of possible vehicles that someone can use for coming out with an opinion about whether the death penalty is constitutional or isn't. I mean, obviously, in Furman versus Georgia and in Gregg versus Georgia in the 70s, the question of the constitutionality of the death penalty was actually fully before the court. And there you had Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall saying that they believed in all circumstances the death penalty would be cruel and unusual punishment. And then Justice Blackmun and Justice Stevens, later on in their careers, issued opinions in which they came to believe the death penalty was unconstitutional. But this was not about whether the death penalty was unconstitutional. It wasn't even about whether lethal injection was unconstitutional. It was about, as you said, that specific drug, midazolam, whether its use in Oklahoma's execution process created the risk of an unconstitutional execution. Is there any indication that you've been able to find as to why Justice Breyer picked this as the vehicle?
Well, I think there were some indications in earlier opinions. Both Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg have been critical about different aspects of the death penalty. And so if you look back at some of the cases that they've written, they have not been issuing glowing praise about the death penalty. In fact, it's the contrary. They've been concerned about the risk of the imposition of the death penalty in a number of other specific contexts. Sometimes I think a justice just makes a decision. Justice Breyer has been on the court for more than 20 years now. He's seen the use of the death penalty up close. When he was on the First Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, he didn't really have an opportunity to handle a really death penalty cases, and he spoke about that during his confirmation hearings back in 1994. So he's had a lot of experience now. I think he's the court's changing. The issue of the death penalty is changing. The drug that it was at issue in the Oklahoma case, midazolam, is actually Pfizer decided they weren't going to sell that drug for use in executions anymore. So there's been developments even since the Glossop case. But I think if you look back at other issues, like Justice Kennedy brought up the issue of solitary confinement, for example, sort of out of the blue. And so sometimes I think judges, especially when they're writing dissenting opinions, have the freedom to raise issues and to invite people to bring challenges to issues that maybe they don't have enough votes for at the moment, but maybe down the road their dissent might turn into a majority position.
Now, you're talking about Justice Kennedy and Justice Breyer and the amount of time that defendants spend on death row. And certainly that's been one of the factors that people have talked about in saying that, well, the death penalty, what kind of deterrent can it be if people languish on death row for 2-3 decades before their cases reach the end of judicial review? But so far, the court has not granted review to decide by itself whether the length of time someone spends on death row is unconstitutional. And death penalty proponents have been arguing that, well, wait a second. How can the amount of time someone spends on death row when they're pursuing their appeals be a ground for the death penalty to be overturned, because they're the ones who are taking advantage of the process? Is there anything in Justice Breyer's opinion that would address any of those issues?
Well, there's this issue, and their so-called lackey claims. It was the first case that brought this up. Justice John Paul Stevens, when he was on the court before he retired, he wanted the court to take up this issue. Justice Breyer joined Justice Stevens in calling for that, and now we have Justice Ginsburg joining Justice Breyer and calling for the court to review this. This issue is important because other countries have recognized that this is a legitimate legal issue to be raising. And actually, if you think about it right now, under international law, the idea of a mock execution is considered to be a torturous practice. Well, a mock execution may not result in any physical harm to the person, but it's the psychological torture of the thinking about you're about to be killed that results in that being classified as a torturous practice. The death row phenomenon, where people spend literally, as Justice Breyer said, more than 17 years in California. There's actually people that have been in death row for more than 30 years. In fact, you're more likely to die of natural causes on death row if you're in California, California's death row, than you are actually to be executed, because California hasn't had an execution in over 10 years now. And so I think in his opinion, he talks about how this is just an extraordinary thing. And if you look back at the founding era, people would never languish on death row for that long. They'd be executed very quickly, within a matter of weeks or at the most months. And nowadays, because of the development of our legal system, we have a heightened awareness of the issue of due process. And actually, one of the things that Justice Breyer talks about is there's a number of cases where people have spent, say, 3 decades on death row, and then they get exonerated. And if they'd been executed quickly, There would have been no exoneration in those cases. We would have had a situation where a wrongfully convicted, a wrongfully sentenced person was executed. And so one of the cases that he talks about actually was the case of Henry Lee McCollum, where Justice Scalia had once said that this person was essentially the poster child for the death penalty. And then McCollum is later exonerated. And that's one of the cases that Justice Breyer talks about in his dissent.
And I think it's interesting, if you look at the exonerations just in 2015, there were six death row exonerations, and in five of those six cases, the people who were on death row were exonerated 30 years or more after their convictions.
Yeah, one of the other cases that Justice Breyer talks about is actually the case of Glenn Ford, who spent three decades on death row, was later exonerated, and he was imprisoned in Louisiana, and unfortunately died of lung cancer just a year after being exonerated. So these are really tragic stories when you think about what's happened here.
Now, when we listen to commentators, you hear a lot about Justice Breyer's dissent being described as an historic opinion or a landmark opinion, and we referred to it here as a landmark opinion. What is it about the opinion that is so historically significant? And what does the opinion mean for the future of the death penalty in the United States?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, you know, Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall, when they were on the court, they stated repeatedly in dissenting opinions that the death penalty was unconstitutional, it was cruel and unusual per se. Sort of, it didn't really matter what the nature of the actual crime was, they thought the punishment was excessive for the crime of murder, for example. And so they relentlessly dissented in those cases. We haven't had a justice on the court for a while who's done that. Justice Blackmun, when he was on the court, he voted to approve the death penalty in a number of cases, and then toward the end of his career, in 1994, he announced that the death penalty was cruel and unusual, and he said he would no longer tinker with the machinery of death. And then he retired from the court. So we haven't really had a voice on the court who said that the death penalty is unconstitutional. Now, in this opinion, as we noted, Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg said the death penalty is likely unconstitutional. But for the reasons we talked about, I think it's unlikely they would shift back now. So it's historic in the sense that we now have two voices on the court who are willing to say that the death penalty is unconstitutional. And actually, in Glossop versus Gross, we had two other justices, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan. And if you look at the language of their dissent, it's Justice Sotomayor was the lead author of that dissent. She described the use of this midazolam drug as potentially resulting in the chemical equivalent of being burned at the stake. And so she actually uses the language of torture in talking about the death penalty. And so I think at this point in time, we really have sort of four real skeptics on the court about the death penalty. Justice Breyer and Ginsburg went somewhat further than Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor at this point. But with Justice Scalia's death, we now have a situation where we have really a 4-4 split on the court on very important Eighth Amendment issues, including about lethal injection.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about. Clearly, at some point, there's going to be a ninth justice, and the court will reach its full complement. But what does this eight-justice situation mean right now for capital punishment cases?
Well, it's a very complicated situation right now because obviously the Senate's not holding hearings even yet to confirm a justice. And we have people have probably read Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Nine. Well, you know, you really could be called the eight right now, and because we're short of justice. And what it means in death penalty cases in particular is that when you have a 4-4 split on the court, as you know, the lower court opinion stands. And so you literally have a situation right now where the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, may not be able to weigh in on a case because to have a stay of an execution, you need 5 votes. For the court to grant review of a case, you only need 4, but if they can't stay it, then the case can become moot very quickly if the person is actually executed. So it's a very odd situation where the highest court in the land would not effectively be able to review the merits of a death penalty case, the most severe punishment that society is meting out.
And what's also interesting is if you have tie votes and what happens in the court below stands, we could conceivably have a situation in which a circuit in one part of the country decides an issue one way, and a circuit in another part of the country decides it another way, and you have two different constitutional rules that are applying in capital cases at the same time, depending on what part of the country you're in.
Yeah, that's right. And normally the U.S. Supreme Court serves that role of resolving those circuit splits. And right now they may simply not be able to do that because they're shorthanded on the court at this point.
You know, Justice Breyer's opinion talks a lot about whether there is an emerging national consensus against the death penalty and whether the increasing abandonment of the death penalty in law and practice makes it cruel and unusual punishment. For years, this legal doctrine has been called the evolving standards. And for years, the courts have been focusing on what's been happening at the state level. As you mentioned, though, Justice Breyer here does something different. He looks at what's going on the state level, and then he moves to the county level. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, there's been an increasing amount of literature on this subject, actually, because people think about, the death penalty, how many states have the death penalty, how many don't. There's more states that right now have the death penalty than do not. But if you look at those states, a lot of these states, if you said, are they active death penalty states, you would say, no, they're not, because they haven't had an execution in many years. Right? I talked about California, more than 10 years, I think. Kansas hasn't had an execution since the 1960s, even though they technically have the death penalty on the books. And so what Justice Breyer does, actually, he attaches several appendices to this to his dissenting opinion. One of them is a map that was published in the Atlantic magazine, which shows actually where the counties are that are actually using the death penalty. And if you look at this, it's a very stark presentation of how few counties throughout the United States are still actively using the death penalty. So it's really a matter now of a few local prosecutors who are preferring the use of the death penalty. It's not that, you know, you would see executions throughout the state of Texas even. You would see them in individual counties. And so that represents the discretion of individual prosecutors bringing death penalty prosecutions.
This is actually an issue that the Death Penalty Information Center has been very interested in. And in 2013, we published a report called the 2% Death Penalty. And it showed that a majority of everybody who's on death row and a majority of everybody who's been executed in the United States have actually come from fewer than 2% of all the counties in the United States. When Justice Breyer was talking about the national consensus and he was talking about arbitrariness, the counties are one of the things that fits in sort of his geographic arbitrariness. But what do you think he would make of an argument that it's not just that it's geographically arbitrary, but there are systemic issues that are behind the proliferation of death sentences in these tiny number of counties? There's a recent report that was just issued by the Fair Punishment Project, which is a project of the Harvard Law School, and it was looking at the 16 counties that have produced the most death sentences over the past 5 years, and it argues that in every one of the counties that it says is overproducing the death penalty, there are systemic criminal justice problems that are not necessarily present in other places. Does it have an effect on the constitutional analysis about the death penalty if it can be shown there are not only very few counties that are seeking the death penalty, but the ones that are have systemic problems in the administration of justice as a whole?
Yeah, I think that's something he'd be very interested in knowing more about, and I think the idea of a full briefing on this issue, because the focus of his opinion is about the arbitrariness of the death penalty itself, and he actually looks, one of his charts looks at, if you look at the states that have the death penalty, what percentage of people actually live in states that are actively using the death penalty? He says that number percentage has gone down dramatically in the last several years. He looks at the county-by-county level. But one of the other things he does in looking at the death penalty, actually, there's some passing references in here to the arbitrariness based upon things like gender and race. And so those are things that would certainly be warranting further exploration. We had the McCluskey versus Kemp case from the late 1980s, which said that a study which showed that there was a systematic racial discrimination in the administration of the death penalty, that that was not a basis for declaring the death penalty unconstitutional, even though Justice Powell later regretted his vote in that case, and it was a 5-4 decision. So had he changed his vote when he was on the court, we would have had a completely different legal landscape at this point. But those are issues that are also factoring in, where you not only have the arbitrariness of the death penalty county by county, but you have some invidious factors, discrimination creeping into the death penalty system. And that issue is also very well documented in terms of that it's occurring. Stephen Bright argued the Foster versus Chapman case, where they had evidence that the prosecutors struck prospective jurors on the basis of race, and the Supreme Court just decided that case just in the last few months.
Does it matter when states move away from the death penalty? There's a famous line in Animal Farm with George Orwell that all pigs are created equal, but some pigs are more equal than others. When it comes to establishing a national consensus for or against the death penalty, in the past, you have a counting of the number of states that have abolished the death penalty, or the number of states that haven't executed anybody. And we're now at a point in which more than 30 states have either legally abolished the death penalty or not executed anybody for more than a decade. Connecticut's Supreme Court just declared its death penalty unconstitutional. The Delaware Supreme Court just declared the manner in which death sentences are imposed in its state unconstitutional. But they're both relatively small states. Does it make a difference if a state like California, which has Proposition 62 on the ballot to repeal the death penalty, does it make a difference if it is a state like California that declares the death penalty, takes the death penalty off the books? Or is this really a bean counting exercise?
No, I think it does make a difference. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people on death row in California. If that were to change, if the voters there were to declare the death penalty unconstitutional, take it out of their constitution, that's a big development. I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that when the Eighth Amendment was initially ratified in 1791, it only applied to the federal government at that point, which at that point was very small. What you have since then, and the Evolving Standards of Decency test, which you referenced, was actually came out in 1958, a case called Troop versus Dulles. And that decision was 4 years before the U.S. Supreme Court actually applied the Eighth Amendment to the states in the case called Robinson in 1962. And with the addition of the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment adds the idea that the states have to follow due process requirements, and there also has to be equal protection of the laws. And I think that the 14th Amendment really changes the 8th Amendment calculus. Whereas before, you know, the 8th Amendment was maybe targeted, maybe outlier punishments, as soon as you add the idea of equal protection of the laws, you really, that applies to punishments as well. And so you need to have punishments being applied equally. And that simply is not happening right now. We're not seeing an equal application of the death penalty. And the Supreme Court building itself, you know, has those words, equal justice under law, right on the front of the facade of the building. And when you see the death penalty being meted out really on a county-by-county basis, and a lot of counties choosing not to use the death penalty, just a handful deciding to use the death penalty, I think that's what Justice Breyer is talking about when he's talking about the cruelty of the arbitrariness of the application of the death penalty in the United States.
What do you think Justice Breyer would make of the argument that some are advancing that because in the text of the Fifth Amendment, capital punishment is mentioned three times in three different clauses, and that because of that, the court can't declare the death penalty to be unconstitutional?
Yeah, that was always Justice Scalia's view of the Constitution. But I think you've got to remember, and the listener should remember, that the provisions in the Bill of Rights were designed as protections for criminal defendants at a time when the death penalty was the mandatory punishment for various crimes, not just murder, but other crimes as well. And so one of the provisions actually that you see in there is this idea of life or limb. Well, you know, we no longer lop people's limbs off in the United States, and I don't think people would say that that's a good idea to do that. And actually, we're at a situation right now where the non-lethal corporal punishments have already been declared unconstitutional. When he was on the Eighth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, Justice Blackmun wrote an opinion in a case coming out of Arkansas called Jackson versus Bishop, where he declared that the flogging, the use of flogging within the Arkansas prisons was unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. And that was in the 20th century. And I think what we have now, what I like to call sort of a, it's kind of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde approach to the Eighth Amendment, in that we have a number of provisions of the statements and cases that say that the Eighth Amendment is designed to protect prisoners from harm, including actually future harm. And so prisoners are protected essentially all the way up to the moment of their executions, at which point the Eighth Amendment turns into more of a vengeful Eighth Amendment. And it's not really a principled reading of the Constitution when you have non-lethal corporal punishments. The court in one case, Hope versus Pelzer, described putting a prisoner out in the hot sun where he got sunburned and dehydrated as an obvious Eighth Amendment violation. And yet you have a more severe punishment, that is the death penalty, that's not treated right now as a violation of the Eighth Amendment. I think once the court were to declare the death penalty unconstitutional, I think the Eighth Amendment itself, the way that the court interprets it, would make a lot more sense.
Over the years, the court, in applying its Eighth Amendment analysis of the death penalty, has looked to a bunch of different indicators of community values. You know, when it says that something offends the evolving national standards of decency, it's looked at legislative judgments, it's looked at whether governors have granted commutations or pardons, it's looked at what prosecutors have done, it's looked at what juries have done, and it's also, in some instances, looked at general public opinion polls. Late September 2016, we get the first poll, national poll, done by the Pew Research Council, Pew Research Center, which shows that for the first time since the Furman decision, fewer than 50% of Americans support the death penalty, or say they support the death penalty. What kind of significance do you think that might have to the court in making a judgment as to whether the death penalty is still constitutional?
Well, I think it makes a big difference. The court's been skeptical of polling itself, by itself, but polling is also reflective of larger societal shifts in public opinion, and that will be reflected in not just lower court rulings like you saw in Connecticut, for example, in the State versus Santiago case where they said the death penalty is unconstitutional, but it's going to be reflected in state legislative activity. One of the most interesting things I think about this issue is that, you know, back in the early American history, you had maybe a few Quakers who were adamantly opposed to the death penalty. They'd be struck from juries, but there would not be a lot of people that would be struck from juries because there was generally a consensus for the use of the death penalty, at least for first-degree murder in those days. But today, where it's so split, what we're now seeing is that two of the things the court looks at as part of its evolving standards of decency test, they look at legislation. Well, in some cases, that legislation may have been passed decades ago, so it may not be very reflective of the current public sentiment towards the death penalty. I mean, it's sometimes harder to remove a law from the books than it is to add it in the first place. And in California, for example, they actually had a constitutional amendment, so it's much more difficult to remove it in California. The other thing, though, is that with juries, people think of, well, if juries are still handing out the death penalty, well, that must reflect that there's still a lot of consensus for the death penalty. But in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court case law allows juries to be death qualified. And that means that anybody who opposes the death penalty is not allowed to sit in judgment in those cases. And because the judgments are typically unanimous, they need to be unanimous, if you just put a random sample of people on juries in capital cases, you would not see anywhere near the number of death sentences being handed out. And we've already seen, even with death qualified juries, the number of death sentences go down from over 300 in the mid-90s to around 100 per year now. And I think that's something that the court's going to need to reexamine, because we're no longer talking about striking a few people. And again, back then, that would have been based upon their religious views. But the Pew Research Center poll that you indicated indicates that you would be striking a larger percentage of minorities from juries. You'd be striking a larger number of women from juries, of young people, of Catholics. These are all things that I think if the court looks at it, that whole practice of death qualification of juries, I think, is really an outdated practice and something the court should reexamine. And especially since they're using jury verdicts as part of the evolving standards of decency test. I mean, they're skewing the data that they're receiving by allowing juries to be death qualified because the public opinion on the death penalty is so evenly split at this point.
That's interesting in two different ways because, you know, I know the case that you were talking about was a 1968 Illinois case, Witherspoon versus Illinois. And in that case, the court specifically said that case was to protect capital defendants against jurors being thrown off because they had simply expressed opposition to the death penalty without being asked whether they would still be able to set aside their beliefs and apply it in the case in front of them. And at that time, the court said that it's important to allow people on the jury because it's through the jury that we see what the contemporary values of society actually are.
Right, and the juries are, the court has said this, represent the sort of the conscience of the community. And if the juries are supposed to represent the conscience of the community, it's hard to see how they can do that when you're excluding at the get-go about half the population, because the poll showed that the views in the death penalty are fairly evenly split. I mean, you have more people actually opposed now. So you're actually, and let's, if we took that to an extreme, and we said in a state that may have 80% opposition to the death penalty, are you going to strike 80% of the people in that state and then let 20% of the people decide the case? And would that reflect the conscience of the community? I don't think so, because that's you're denying participation. Actually, you're denying people participation based upon their political views of the death penalty itself.
And that was one of the issues that came up very recently in the Tsarnaev case, the Boston Marathon bombing case, because the polls there showed that 2/3 of Boston residents were opposed to the death penalty, yet they were all excluded from participating in the case because they could not impose a death penalty. They said they couldn't impose a death penalty. And you end up in a circumstance like that, not just having those people not being able to vote on whether the defendant should live or die, but probably even more importantly, their views about the case are not present in the deliberation room. So you have other jurors who are trying to do their job, and they're trying to do it fairly, but they might be persuaded by arguments by people who think differently. But that entire group of people, and in the case of Boston, 2/3 of the public, is excluded from the jury.
When you're engaging in this death qualification process, number one, it takes a lot longer to select a jury because, especially in places where there's opposition, significant opposition to the death penalty, you also end up with, in a lot of places, all-white juries or nearly all-white juries. And because as the Pew Research Center polling reflects, you're eliminating a disproportionate number of women, a disproportionate number of Catholics and other religious groups. So you're seeing discrimination based upon the First Amendment, based upon religion, and you're ending up with really skewed data in terms of allowing the U.S. Supreme Court, which has set up this test in the first place, to really gauge what the public sentiment is in actual cases. It's one thing when you call somebody up on the phone and you're a Gallup pollster and you say, well, do you favor or oppose the death penalty, or do you favor the death penalty versus life without parole? And the person in a very short 2-minute conversation will pronounce their opinion. It's a very different thing when you're actually sitting in a jury box deciding whether or not to impose the ultimate punishment on somebody. And the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hearst case, recent case, declared that juries have that role, that judges alone cannot do that. So juries are particularly important in the death penalty context in deciding whether somebody's going to live or die. And if you're eliminating people from that jury box based upon their own personal views, which is just unfair, it seems to me.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Hearst, because one of the things that commentators have said about the death penalty and the Supreme Court's role in the death penalty is that there's a sense of inevitability that sooner or later the court is going to have to decide whether the death penalty is constitutional or not. But in the interim, there's been a kind of death by 1,000 cuts, and you have little issues coming up one at a time, and sometimes not so little issues. You've got the court overturning the death penalty for people with intellectual disability and overturning the death penalty for juvenile offenders. Now, in the Hearst case, you have them taking a particular outlier practice. Florida was the only state that allowed the death penalty without a jury finding that the defendant was eligible for the death penalty. That finding was completely discretionary, and the judge could impose his own fact-finding, ignore what the state did. And now we see challenges to Florida and Alabama and Delaware based on the fact that they allow death sentences either by jury, the judge overriding the judgment of the jury, or when the jury is not unanimous. So we're seeing the court address these smaller death penalty issues. Do you think, with the Glossop opinion, the court is any closer to addressing the big issue, or is it going to be continuing to take cases sort of one at a time that address smaller parts of the issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say. It's hard to predict the future, of course, but I think that you have to see this in the context of the larger global conversation that's going on about the death penalty. The United Nations has a movement to try to put a moratorium on the death penalty globally. South Africa's constitutional court back in the mid-90s declared the death penalty unconstitutional. You've seen countries like Mongolia abolish the death penalty recently. And so I think, you know, the court is living in that global environment. Justice Breyer himself written a book called The Court in the World, where he talks about how for those that would say, well, we should just ignore all international law, ignore all foreign law, well, you really can't do that in the way that we live today. I mean, we have international adoptions. You know, we have cases that international business transactions. It's a complex world which we live in. And you have cases of torture where people then come to the United States. They may seek compensation for the torture that they suffered. And so we're really living in a global environment. And the European Union already views the death penalty through a human rights lens. And so they are refusing to extradite people to the United States if they would face the death penalty. And there's actually, under the European Convention on Human Rights, there's two protocols, Protocol 6 and Protocol 13, which first abolished the death penalty in peacetime, and then Protocol 13 abolished it even in wartime. And so Europe is essentially a death penalty-free zone, and we have justices who occasionally travel to Europe, and they have conversations with jurists from Europe. And so I'm sure that they're getting questions about, well, what is it about the United States? Why are you still using this particular practice? And I myself think it's kind of a vestige of the Dark Ages still. We're still using a penalty which was, you know, used back in the Middle Ages, even though we've gotten rid of things like ear cropping, cutting people's ears off, the use of the pillory, the non-lethal corporal punishments. And so I think, you know, it's possible that there will be enough votes soon. You only need four votes to grant review of a case where the court is willing to take up the issue of, is the death penalty unconstitutional? And that is the question that the court is asked to address. And then you would hear all this evidence, factual evidence about the number of exonerations, about the arbitrariness of the death penalty, and we would have evidence that we'd actually be looking at. You know, Justice Breyer, in his opinion, is citing a lot of things that are were not in the record before the court, that are outside the record, but that are well-known facts at this point, that the death penalty is arbitrary, and essentially taking judicial notice of the fact that, you know, there's arbitrariness in the use of the death penalty, and there's been a number of cases where people have been convicted wrongfully.
Fascinating stuff. Well, thank you, John, for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
John Bessler's book, Against the Death Penalty, is available from Brookings Institution Press. To learn more about Glossop v. Gross, Justice Breyer's dissent, and other death penalty issues, visit deathpenaltyinfo.org. To make sure you receive each new episode of Discussions with Deepak, please subscribe via iTunes or your podcast app of choice.